Welcome to Season 4 of the Fight Science Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Sullivan. In this series, we're speaking to some of the most innovative minds in the world of sports nutrition. We'll be discussing everything from research, practice, and performance to give you an inside look into the exciting world of combat sports performance. Today, my guest is Dr. Lewis James. Dr. Lewis obtained a Bachelor of Science in Food Science with Nutrition from the University of Reading, where he also completed a Master's of Science in Sport and Exercise Nutrition. He obtained his PhD from Loughborough University, which focused on human water balance. Dr. Lewis is currently the deputy lead for Loughborough University's sports performance research and teaches the school's undergraduates in sports nutrition and postgraduate students in applied nutrition. In this episode, we discuss theoretical and practical considerations around the strategies for acute weight loss. We discuss how energy intake, fluid, and sodium are all connected, and what needs to be considered after the weigh-in to ensure adequate rehydration and refueling. There's a lot of good info here, and there's a lot to get through. So let's get to it. All right, green light means we are live. So back for another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. So back for Season 4. So Season 4, we are running our gut health series alongside our regular performance nutrition series. So we're coming back to performance nutrition, and we're going back to England. England seems to be giving us many, many great researchers and many great discussions this season. But we're coming back over. We're joined by Dr. Lewis James. Lewis, thanks for coming on, mate.
Pleasure, Jordan. Good to be here. Thanks for the invite.
Yeah, of course. Now, Dr. Lewis, we were talking a bit off air, and I think in terms of researchers, we don't always go into their backstory, but I really want you to talk about how you got into MMA and your history, because you've really been a lifelong enthusiast and practitioner in MMA, right?
Yeah. I've always done kind of martial arts since a really young age. So judo initially, and then taekwondo. And then I transitioned at university from taekwondo into MMA. I just found, you know, too many restrictions. Started doing some grappling, you know, submission wrestling for me. I never did Brazilian jiu-jitsu, never wore a gi, but I really loved it. And then that combined with, you know, the taekwondo and all the boxing I did, it just made sense to do that. Had a few amateur fights, and then got a neck injury that meant I couldn't really grapple anymore, and then dropped out of it and went more down the research route. So yeah, still interested. You know, love watching MMA. Always, you know, catch up on UFC pretty much whenever it's on.
Yeah, and you were based out of Nottingham, is that right? Who were some of the guys that you used to train with?
So originally kind of started training with a few guys at the uni, one of whom ended up competing in the UFC, a guy called Niko Shipshak. He went through the Ultimate Fighter and whatnot. But then more broadly at that time, we had the Roughhouse crew that were training in Nottingham and Leicester. And so I was kind of quite regularly training with a lot of those guys, you know, two or three times a week. I was one of the grappling partners for them. So, you know, people like Dan Hardy, Judo Jimmy Wallhead, Andre Winner, Paul Semtex Daly was around as well a bit. Dean Amersinger a little bit. He was not around so much, but more those other guys. Yeah. So training really regularly with them. And that kind of got me a kind of big introduction into what a lot of the higher level athletes do from a weight cutting and a kind of weight regain point of view. And made me really start to think about that. And to be honest, formed a lot of my research interests today. Whilst I don't do that much in MMA, it's a big like side interest of mine, and I'd love to. We just can't really get access to the athletes. Loughborough's quite a small town, and there's not that many athletes in and around. So most of my focus is on things that are relevant for weight cutting, things like dehydration and the effects of dehydration on performance, and energy restriction and all those sort of things, but transitioned into slightly other areas rather than specifically the weight cut.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'd still love to get your opinion on it, because you gave a really fantastic talk at the ACSM annual conference talking about, I think it was called Putting Things Back Together After the Weight Cut or something along those lines. And it was really fascinating, especially coming from me,
considering I do that a lot, you know, it's my full-time job with guys and we're doing that. I found the topics you spoke about were extremely innovative and extremely novel and things that I had myself not even considered. So let's just go from the start and let's talk about that final week, that final, let's call it the fight week, where we're kind of starting this weight descent. Let's just talk, go from the top. What are your thoughts about it all? And what are the things that you consider when you often discuss these?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing to consider is the kind of health and safety side of things. And I think that's something that has been front of mind since, you know, I first started exploring this type of thing, maybe, late 2000s, 2006, seven, that's that sort of time. I think, you know, more recently, we've had quite a lot of deaths in MMA athletes, Thai boxers, the like, but there were lots of that type kind of thing in wrestlers many years ago. You know, a lot of the stuff that we talk about in MMA and perhaps consider new has been talked about for years and years and years with wrestlers, and there's loads of really good research out there with wrestlers to lean on. So that was the first thing, and to be honest, that was kind of what got me out of advising athletes. You know, I found it a little bit, it was a double-edged sword, because I was like, I've got all this information that could help somebody. And, you know, these guys are doing really quite scary things. You know, I know of people who voluntarily gave blood before making weight to reduce their weight, you know, and yeah, they only give like half a kilo or whatever, but still it's half a kilo that they don't have to lose in another way. But that's, you know, an extremely potentially dangerous thing. So that kind of made me really think about whether it's right to be advising athletes. But then I kind of come back to this, you know, we've got this knowledge that can help somebody do it more safely. It might still not be 100% safe, but it's more safe. And really where that lies from an ethical perspective as a practitioner, making recommendations on some of the things that you can do. My personal belief is that you can quite safely lose quite large amounts of weight quite quickly. And certainly a lot of the athletes that I worked with were kind of in that 10% range of body weight loss in that, you know, 5-6 days before making weight. And I think if you portion that up to where you take that weight from and you rely less on dehydration as a method, then you can make that process a little bit safer. And I think you can lose weight that you can then easily regain. And I think that's consistent with lots of really high level MMA athletes. You know, probably around the 10% mark is about what most athletes would typically do. But how they do that, in my view, is really, really important. And that's the crux, is what strategies do you use to try and facilitate that weight loss?
Yeah, and absolutely, you're absolutely spot on, because that's the difference between you doing this safely and you not doing it safely. I think everyone in the field, at least in the academic side, will say, yeah, 8 to 10% is pretty good, but 8 to 10% of water cutting or losing that through, you know, rapid dehydration probably isn't considered safe. Lewis, what type of things are you doing to ensure that final water cut or that rapid dehydration in the final phase is as small as possible?
Yeah, so it's making sure you're drawing things from other avenues, and the two that you can probably get some weight from is reducing glycogen. And I know this will have been talked about on the podcast before, but typically if you reduce glycogen, you also get a loss of water. People will quote different numbers at you as to how much water there is bound with each gram of glycogen. There is no hard and fast number. And you do see a dissociation between those two things. And there's data out there that I could show you that shows that you can store glycogen with less water or more water. It doesn't have a fixed relationship. But when you put people on a glycogen depleting regime, you do seem to lose a little bit of water from the cell as well. So that's the first one. And then the second one is basically taking everything you possibly can out of the GI tract. So using things like low residue diets and specific types of diet that mean you have less in your GI tract. One of the things that we used to use when I was practicing and working with athletes was that I've never seen really anyone else use, but it did seem to work, and it's only anecdotal. There's no scientific evidence out there, but I used to load fiber a little bit.
Yeah.
So we'd get this like wheat bran, We'd normally mix it with like yogurts and things like that because it tasted horrible. You could put it with water, but it just absorbs everything. And we'd put people on slightly higher fiber diets for a good little while. What you tend to find with athletes that are making weight is they've restricted their diet quite a lot. And so they don't have so much fiber perhaps in their diet. So we would up it a little bit. And then maybe for the last 3 days before weigh-in, we would just cut it completely out. And we would find that people would go to the toilet a lot, but they would lose quite a lot of weight. I remember one athlete in particular who was a powerlifter and wanted to cut down to the minus 125 kilo weight category. He lost something like 7 kilos in a day just through mostly going to the toilet. They really like loaded out, as it were. But most people, when you consider the GI tract, probably you can get from most people 1 to 2 kilos, I would say, out through that mechanism. And an important thing to say there, and with the next thing that we'll talk about, is that you want somebody going into that final week as well fed as possible, almost. The more depleted they are at that point, the less you're going to get out of them through means other than dehydration. And that's when you potentially have a bigger health risk with that individual athlete, for me. And so I think MMA and weight category sports in general are crazy because some people's fight camps will be almost as long as, say, a really good endurance athlete's taper for like an Olympics or something like that. You know, so we're talking about really short periods, and they spend all of that period focusing on diet, focusing on weight, rather than focusing on their actual training. And if we can change that mindset to allow them to focus more on their training and less on their diet, come into camp at a slightly, you know, better weight, then they're not focusing throughout the camp on that diet, and they come into the final week in a better state and able to lose a little bit more through means other than dehydration. So low residue diet, clear out the GI tract, and then also low kind of carbohydrate diet in those final few days to try and take off the glycogen, really. Clearly energy restriction is there as well. And some level of energy restriction will also reduce body weight. Sodium restriction will also reduce body weight. But one of the things you need to bear in mind is that both energy restriction and sodium restriction will have an impact on blood and plasma volume. And people think that those techniques don't influence hydration and don't see them as dangerous dehydrating techniques. But we've seen reductions of up to 10% of plasma volume in 48 hours with energy restriction and sodium restriction. So that means when you go into your dehydration phase, so whether that's active or passive or whatever it is, you're then at a lower starting plasma volume. And that again could be dangerous.
Hey Lewis, just for the people at home, could you just explain what plasma volume is and why it's important?
Yeah, so the plasma is the water portion of your blood. So within your blood, you have the cells, so red cells, white cells, et cetera, et cetera. And then you have the water component. Typically, the water component is about 60% of the blood. And that's really what regulates, or blood volume specifically, is what regulates cardiovascular function. And so all of your kind of cardiovascular risk, as it were, is probably dictated partly, at least, by the volume of the blood and then the composition. And if you've got a low volume and a very low content of plasma as well in the blood, then that's when you're probably at risk of some of the cardiovascular events that we've seen happen in some athletes and that have led to deaths in athletes. It's responsible for things like thermoregulation, delivery of nutrients to various sites in the body and removal of waste products as well.
And you could be in that decreased plasma volume state before you even start the active or passive dehydration, where you're actively looking to reduce the fluid in the body.
Yeah, exactly. We've done studies. So there's one study that was part of my PhD where we looked at different restriction methods, different dietary restriction methods. So either fluid restriction on its own, so adequate energy, zero fluid, adequate fluid, but very low energy, so energy restriction on its own. Combination of those two, fluid and energy restriction, and then a controlled trial as well for just a 24-hour period. The difficult thing with the research and translating it and putting it into an MMA context is what the athletes do could probably never be researched. So we have to like take little pieces of the puzzle from all over the place and put them together. But what we saw in that study was that if you restrict fluid, you see a reduction in plasma volume. If I restrict food but allow adequate fluid, and I'm talking like 3.5 liters probably for the day, what people normally have, you see that same reduction in blood and plasma volume. So if you're just energy restricting and not fluid restricting, you see the same loss in blood volume, same kind of reduction in hydration, as it were, as if you were restricting fluid. You feel a lot better, you feel good, but you don't have that blood and plasma volume anymore. And the reason for that is when we restrict food intake, we restrict everything else that's there as well. So if we restrict food intake, we'll restrict all the macronutrients, we'll restrict all the micronutrients, and particularly the electrolytes, sodium and potassium, that are responsible for extracellular and intracellular water homeostasis, are restricted. And that means you lose body water at the same time as restricting energy intake.
Lewis, what was your guys' definition of energy restriction? Was it per kilogram basis, or was it just a set amount of calories per day, or how did you guys define it?
So we got them to do a diet diary for a day that we considered their norm. And then for the severe, we call it severe energy restriction, we went for 25% of the calories that they had in their normal diet. So I think we were around the 600 mark, something like that. So kind of low. We then did a follow-up study. Well, I did a number of follow-up studies in my PhD, but one of the ones that's published is 2 days at around 33% of estimated energy requirements. So that was around 900 kilocalories. And we saw the same reduction. If you drop to 900 kilocalories and have a reduction in your sodium and potassium intakes during that time, we saw a reduction in plasma volume of 10% over the 2 days. When we fed those electrolytes back in, so we had another trial where we energy restricted but didn't electrolyte restrict, we didn't see that reduction in plasma volume.
So it is quite possible, Lewis, if you were smart about your energy restriction, that you were eating foods that was still giving you those electrolytes and still giving you enough energy, you can mitigate that effect.
Yeah, that's my belief and understanding from the research. Yeah, you can. So it's all about the electrolytes, basically. And this isn't new. We've known this since like the 60s. When you look back at the literature, you know, if you look at some of the studies that were done with long term starvation in the 60s. And 70s, or even go back further and look at, like, you know, Ansel Keys' work from the 40s, some of those Minnesota starvation experiments. You can see the data in there, and the link between energy restriction and body water homeostasis is clear.
And so when you're advising, say, your combat athletes, or say theoretical considerations, are you advising them to restrict this sodium because of this, or is there a cutoff amount that you would say, hey, yeah, we do need to reduce, but don't go below this? Or how do you play that? Or is that not even a consideration?
I personally, with those athletes in those final few days, I'd keep sodium down anyway. I think if you can, as long as you're aware of it when you're going into that, you know, any dehydration you do, and you can really take note of it, then you can get some weight off them that is a bit easier to get off. You know, it's like a similar thing, and the thing we haven't talked about, the kind of water loading that has been around for years, and Reed Reel's done some really nice research on that topic. I think his studies are the only studies in the literature, but yeah, again, it's a small, tiny little gain of weight loss that you get, but it's better than spending an extra, you know, hour or whatever in a sauna when you've already spent 6 hours in a sauna for some of those athletes. So if you can lose some of that weight through other means, then it's just easier on the athlete. But the thing you need to be aware of as a practitioner, as a coach, is that just because they haven't started actively trying to dehydrate, the other processes that you use in that perhaps 3, 4, 5 days running up to that time that they might spend in a hot bath or a sauna or actively sweating out weight, they are already dehydrated at that stage. I think that's a bit of a misconception with a lot of practitioners. They think they're not using dehydration, but by restricting energy or restricting sodium, you are inducing dehydration.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the first thing that comes to my mind is that if you've done the process correctly and you've managed your fight camp, and it's a fight camp, not a fat camp, and you haven't spent the whole time trying to lose weight, and you're not being drastic in that final week, maybe that 10% plasma volume is it doesn't matter. Maybe that's not a consideration. What does come to my mind is the guys that come into the fight week above 10% out, and then they're doing these drastic dehydration protocols, or they're energy restricting, they're salt restricting, but then they're still left with 5+, anywhere between 5 and 10% of their weight to lose through fluid in that final 24 hours. Is that when this would become really problematic?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think we can put a number on it. It's different and individual for each athlete, and it will depend on what they've done. When you look and study the cases where people have, very sadly died, the weight loss that they see in that final couple of days isn't often huge. There's some MMA athletes that, have been trying to lose like 20% of their body weight in that last few days, and that unfortunately has led to death. But the cases that are better recorded, the weight loss that acutely results in the death of that athlete eventually is normally set on a background of a long-term weight loss diet, and we're talking kilos and kilos and kilos over long periods of time. So they've been energy restricting, glycogen depleting, etc. for weeks or months. So they're coming into that stage in a really really bad place. So I think that probably is implicated in some of those effects. I mean, when you look at other settings, and we like to just look at our sport and go, well, there's no research on MMA. We need the research on MMA, and we do definitely need research on MMA, but you can take so much information from other sports, and the one I always use for kind of acute dehydration and effects like that is go and read some of the literature that looks at marathon running, and the effects of marathon running on body weight and hydration. There's some nice data on some elite level marathon runners, particularly Haile Gebrselassie, when he tried to break the world record in Dubai in 2009. And there's all his data on how much weight he lost during that marathon attempt. He ran a marathon in 2 hours, 5 minutes. Okay, didn't quite break the world record. He was the holder at the time, but it ended up raining in Dubai, and that slowed him down. Probably, 2 days a year that it rains, and it's on the world record attempt for him. And in that marathon, he lost nearly 10% of his body weight. And he drank, I think, nearly 2 liters of water during that marathon. So, we see these things in other places as well. We see these weight losses. And for him, some of that will be substrate, but most of it will be body water. So we're seeing acute dehydration in that range of what's seen with these MMA athletes. But he's still able to perform optimally. And, there are loads of questions that springs, but the point I'm making is that we see these levels, 5, 6, 7% dehydration all the time in other sports. What sets MMA apart is this background of poor diet. And I say poor diet in that it's meant to be there to try and get them to lose weight. And then that dehydration is set from that lower starting point. With someone like, Gebrselassie, we're seeing the opposite. We're seeing glycogen loading. We're seeing water, high water intake, high sodium intakes, all of those sort of things to make him optimal at the start of the race. But we do see those sort of levels of loss in so many other places.
Hey guys, I just wanted to jump in here and it'll be quick. I know, I'm not a fan of ads either, but this isn't an ad. Well, it is, but I literally get nothing out of doing this. I just want to give a shout out to some of the businesses that have helped and continue to help me along my journey. Before You Speak is quite possibly one of the fastest growing coffee brands coming out of Australia. To be quite honest, I'm a bit of a coffee snob, and these guys have absolutely ruined coffee for me. I literally cannot drink anything else. As a matter of fact, one of my UFC fighters loves it so much that when we were cutting weight for one of his fights, he made me factor in the weight of a Before You Speak coffee so he could have it the morning before he weighed in. That's a true story, and I have a video of it on my Instagram. This stuff is legit, and if you want to try it, they have been kind enough to do a discount code for my listeners. Just head to their website and enter TFD10 to receive a 10% discount. All right, back to the podcast.
This is probably a good segue to bring us into this post-weigh-in period, Lewis. How much of an effect, and this can be theoretical on your end, or there might be research about it, how much of an effect, say if you're going into that already depleted, or you've got this plasma volume depletion, you complete this water cut and you go through and you drop whatever number it is, whatever percent of your body weight, and then it comes time to put it all back in. What are some of the things we need to consider in that? Does that affect that, and how well your body will take up those electrolytes or the glucose and the glycogen restoration? Does that background diet affect that protocol?
Yeah, I think there's a number of ways that it could or couldn't. So what we typically see is, there's a small amount of data that does show some kind of some biochemical measures with some of these athletes. What you typically see is things like high plasma sodium, high plasma osmolality or serum osmolality. And so we are seeing what we call hypertonic hypohydration. So that's dehydration that increases the concentration of body fluids with most of these athletes. In that situation, you shouldn't see too much of a change in water balance response to drinking that you would with a kind of normal exercise-induced dehydration, which is where most of our knowledge comes from in that space. But if you do have an athlete that has used techniques that don't result in that increased concentration of body fluids, so things like energy restriction, things like sodium restriction, some athletes might even use diuretics, whether they're natural diuretics or whether they're what diuretics they shouldn't be using. But in those situations, you see slightly different changes in body water homeostasis, and that might lead to slight changes in the rehydration protocol. But broadly, my view is that you can probably get most of the body fluids back into people that they lose, except for some really extreme examples. As long as you are replacing the minerals, the electrolytes that they're losing alongside that body water loss, so particularly things like sodium, then you should be able to get a lot of that water back in. And that, I guess, is evidenced from when you look at athletes' weight regain, they do put that weight back on. We don't have data to show where that water is, but if the water's in the body and you've had appropriate electrolytes, it should redistribute within the body quite well. Where perhaps there is some difference, I think, is with the glycogen reload. And that's where I think, and we don't have the data, so some of it has to be theoretical in nature. But there are a couple of things there with glycogen with weight category and MMA athletes in particular that might mean that they perhaps aren't fully topped up at fight time. So most of what we know about glycogen resynthesis is taken from exercise literature. And what exercise does on its own is put in place the capability of the muscle to increase the amount of glycogen that gets resynthesized. So if we have exercise versus no exercise, we'll see greater glycogen resynthesis when exercise is in place. However, with a lot of these athletes, they don't do exercise immediately before eating. So we typically see increased exercise in maybe the 2-3 days before the weigh-in, but the day of the weigh-in, if we're assuming this is like a normal kind of UFC type weigh-in where, you've got that weigh-in, midday kind of time, a bit earlier, perhaps sometimes, depends on where they're fighting. You don't see much exercise on that day. It's mostly passive weight loss techniques. So sitting in a sauna or a hot bath or, those sort of things. So those techniques on their own won't stimulate glycogen resynthesis. So you're starting from a position where your body isn't trying to resynthesize glycogen. It will do it, but it will do it more slowly. And I question sometimes whether that recovery period is long enough to fully replenish glycogen. The other thing that weight category athletes do quite a lot is they use low carbohydrate diets in the lead up to a fight to facilitate weight loss. They seem to work quite well for weight loss, and you know, maybe they manage with it. If you are continuously using a low carbohydrate diet, you will downregulate all of the kind of apparatus that allows you to use glycogen at a fast rate during exercise. And if we think about a UFC athlete, for example, most of what they do is what we would call glycolytic. So it's a lot of glycolysis. But by training with low glycogen continuously over a prolonged period of time, they downregulate all of the enzymes and all of the things that within the muscle allow you to use that glycogen at a fast rate. So they're actually potentially limiting their performance by doing that. And there's some really nice research out there from various groups around the world that shows if you periodize carbohydrate intake, you can prevent against that. And that's one thing that these athletes could do to use the glycogen.
Yeah, absolutely. Lewis, can we come back to the point when we were talking about that most of these guys, when they've done their dehydration, whatever, their body is in that hypertonic hyperhydration. Is there a set protocol, say, with sodium that you would recommend that would help promote that come in? Is there certain levels that we know of, or is it dependent on the individual and you'd run a sweat test, or how would you go about that if you wanted to promote the getting the electrolytes back in?
Yeah, I mean, you can look at individualizing it, and we do that with a lot of sports actually. So, you know, with some of the sports that I've worked with on hydration practices, so you know, football or soccer, and triathlon and some other endurance sports, we do look at measuring losses and trying to individualize things. You could do that with an athlete, and if you've got the facility to do it, then I think it would be a good thing to do. That the one point on that I would make is, don't make the assumption that what you measure 3 weeks out from the fight will be what their concentration will be at fight time. We know that sweat sodium concentrations can change. And if somebody goes through sodium deficit, their sweat sodium will be conserved and they will reduce their concentration. So the measurement that you would make at fight time or at kind of rapid weight loss time won't be the same as 3-4 weeks out. But you could do that, and you could make that measurement in one camp and inform that choice you make there and also in future camps. But I think you don't necessarily need that. We kind of know from the literature what is optimal for rehydration. So if you look at oral rehydration solutions that, you know, are promoted by World Health Organization and, you know, other organizations as well, they're typically in that range of about 60 millimoles per liter. So if you were to get a Dioralite in the UK, or I think it's called Pedialyte in the
Pedialyte, Hydralyte, yeah.
They're in that range, and all of those types of drinks are done based on that WHO formula. So they have that kind of range, and that's what's kind of optimal. If you go much higher than that, you really, I mean, they taste quite salty anyway. But any higher than that, and you can see changes in electrolyte balance, particularly with potassium, that might influence that recovery process. Lower than that, and you'll perhaps get suboptimal retention of the drink that you consume. But the thing you need to think about when somebody's looking to rehydrate is also how that fluid tastes, and how easy it is for that athlete to actually make that drink up. If you just use one of those oral rehydration solutions, the athlete won't want to consume that much of it, but you want them to drink maybe 4 or 5 liters. So you've got this like trade-off. So the thing I used to do with the athletes that I worked with, so I used to make the drinks myself when I was working with the athletes, and if possible I would go to the weigh-in and I would be there with like a cup, be like, right, drink this now. And the reason I used to do that was because I could keep on top of the rate at which they drank, to A, make sure they drink enough, and B, make sure that they don't drink it so fast that they're going to potentially run into problems with things like hyponatremia. But what when the athletes that I was working with started, you know, going to the big shows and things like that, and I wasn't necessarily able to come with them, we started working on using commercially available sports drinks. So they're around 6% glucose or 6% carbohydrate, depending on where you go, and mixing that with a certain amount of water to dilute it down a little bit so it wasn't too high carbohydrate, and adding in the kind of oral rehydration sachets to give them something that tasted nice, that they could easily access in any country in the world that they might go to and fight, and also it would provide what they needed from a rehydration point of view. So we brought it down a little bit and we're more in that kind of 50 millimole per liter range probably. And that seems to work quite well. You'll get good retention of the drink. If you retain the drink in the blood, it will then diffuse into the other tissues of the body, as long as you're not too out of whack with electrolyte balance. And as long as you're providing them with potassium to allow that fluid to go into the intracellular space as well. Sodium will hold it in the body of, you know, initially, and then it will diffuse into the cells as well. So yeah, we were going with around 50 millimoles per liter. And again, the research on those types of drinks is that's about optimal as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess if we're thinking about putting it back together, and during that week, the fluid and the sodium is two big compartments, and the other big component is the glycogen, which we were discussing. And like you said, if we're theoretically considering that, say, glycogen resynthesis may be halted due to the lack of translocation of these GLUT4 receptors and everything else, is there anything else that a fighter, say, could take that could help get these get that glycogen resynthesized faster or more efficiently?
Yeah, sure. One more thing actually on the hydration, just while you were talking there, you made me think about something else. There is this crossover between carbohydrate intake and rehydration. And again, this is something that particularly with some of these MMA athletes, you need to be really careful about, because if you have a high carbohydrate concentration in your drink, you get slightly better drink retention. Okay. You can retain more of the drink that you consume. But the negative to that is that the drink doesn't get in so quickly. So we did a study a while back where we used like gastric feeding tubes and things like that to be able to measure the rate at which the drink is coming out of the stomach. We dehydrated people by about 2% of their body weight. So, you know, relatively mild dehydration by an MMA kind of setting. We then gave them 150% of their fluid losses as either 2% or 10% carbohydrate drink. So 10% is important because it's consistent with, say, soft drinks that are out there, and some rehydration drinks as well that some athletes might use. With the 10% drink, when we measured how much of that drink was left in their stomach, 2 hours after starting drinking, they still had 50% of that drink in their stomach. With a 2% drink, it was all gone. You know, completely emptied. And that had this effect on blood volume, where with the 2% drink, a hypotonic drink, we call it, something that's below the concentration of blood, we see this really rapid rise in plasma volume, which is really important for people post weigh-in. So the reverse was true in the 10% carbohydrate drink. We actually saw, it wasn't statistically different, but we actually saw a reduction in plasma volume on drinking. So because that carbohydrate content is so high in osmolality, it draws water out of the blood into the intestines to absorb it. So immediately after weighing in, having really high carbohydrate content in a drink, or perhaps even consuming food alongside that to a lesser extent, might mean that the rehydration you get isn't so rapid. And if that athlete's at health risk, then really you want to try and promote rapid rehydration. So high sodium, lowish carbohydrate, maybe 2-4% max, and then get the fluids back into them initially. Recover that plasma volume and then deal with the other things.
My mind is thinking, well, due to the mechanics of the stomach, does it make more sense then to put the fluid in and then eat your carbohydrates as they'll come in a bit slower naturally?
Yeah, I've been doing a bit of reading on that recently. We did a little pilot study with some MSc students a few years ago. And when you start reading the literature on what the stomach actually does and how it handles foods, it's it's really fascinating. I had this theory that just to improve kind of the hydration that you get out of a drink, what we could do is drink the drink after a meal. Because in theory, right, the meal's in the stomach, the drink comes in. This was me thinking, and this is like 2 years ago now, you know, so you put the drink in, and then what will happen is the drink will mix with the food that's in the stomach, and that will give us better retention of that drink. So we'll be able to get better hydration. And in normal athletes, not MMA athletes, you know, trying to get the most bang for your buck out of a drink is really important in everyday training. Actually, what we saw was almost the reverse. When we gave them the drink after eating, as opposed to before eating, we saw greater urine output. So we got worse hydration. And when we started doing the reading and looking into the literature from years ago, those two processes almost happen separately. So your foods come in and your drinks come in around the food, just diffuse down, and then can be absorbed almost separately. So yeah, having the carbohydrate in a food form as opposed to in a liquid form might allow you both of those benefits. And that is theoretical, I have to say, although that study it does support that, but it's not published. So, and as my prof Ron Morn used to say, if it's not published, it doesn't count. You know, he used to say, if it's not published, it didn't happen. So for me, I would go food and fluid separate. You know, having a small carbohydrate content in your drink is a good thing. It can speed the absorption in the intestines of the fluid, and having a high sodium content is good because when it gets to the blood, it stays there. And then feed your carbohydrates in small meals, and that was actually what we used to do like 10 or 15 years ago. So we would do drinks in 2 to 4% carbs, high sodium, and then we would use at that time, you know, Jaffa cakes and biscuits and things like that to get some of those carbs in. So I think that would be the strategy that I would recommend. Separate those two processes out.
And coming back to the question about the glycogen resynthesis, is there anything you can do, like if we're left in this unknown of, okay, we didn't translocate the GLUT4, is there anything we can take that will help at least theoretically put that glycogen back in?
Yeah, the one that I've used in the past, and I think you've had some conversations about this in previous podcasts, is creatine. I typically, with weight category athletes, I would steer away from creatine because of the associated increase in weight that happens. If somebody's trying to lose weight and they've got an extra kilo to lose, it's not a positive thing for them. There's some really nice research that shows that consuming creatine can more rapidly resynthesize muscle glycogen. You also, even within 24 hours, get a lot of that creatine into the muscle, and you can increase the muscle creatine content. So that's a double positive. One, you get that greater increase in muscle glycogen. And two, you have an increase in muscle creatine content that would probably enhance some aspects of performance in MMA athletes.
Yeah. Does that study, I'm not sure if it specifies, but does it specify whether that person or the individuals in the study used creatine prior, or were they physiologically loaded, or were they not, or was it just never taken and then, hey, have this creatine?
So in that study, and there's two studies. The one I used to lean on was a study from the 90s. And then a few years ago, there was another study, and the study from the 90s looks at like 6 hours after starting the creatine intake, and then 6 days, I think, or 5 days. And at 5 or 6 days, you see this trend, quite a big trend, to be honest, and it's small subject numbers. So I'd almost take a trend as a significant effect for an increase in glycogen content. So I always hypothesized that somewhere between those two measures, you probably would see an increase in glycogen. And then this study published a few years ago showed it after 24 hours. And that's 24 hours after starting creatine supplementation. So it does seem to happen without that prior intake of creatine. And I think that's probably important because certainly, you know, maybe you use creatine as part of your base training, but I think it's like 4 to 6 weeks at least for the muscle creatine levels to come back down to baseline. So in that kind of final stages of the fight camp, maybe the 6 weeks, you don't want to be taking creatine. So the fact that the creatine may work outside of any kind of background creatine intake is quite important for me. There's also another study that, again, the researcher that did the study came to my university when I was doing my PhD, so I had quite a few conversations with him about it. And again, that was another one that got me onto creatine, and that was nothing about muscle glycogen. That was about performance. And they did a study where they took wrestlers, this was in Estonia. They took wrestlers, and I think they lost about 5% of their body weight. And then they did one of two treatments. They either gave them creatine in the recovery period that was, I think it was around a day. It was just under a day, I think, if my memory is correct. Or no creatine, and they saw that when they were given creatine, their performance was better at that kind of fight time. And it was mostly kind of muscle strength related performances and things like that, things that would be relevant for MMA for sure. So not only do we see that potentially glycogen could go up, there is a performance benefit there as well. So it's perhaps an easy win for an MMA athlete in that recovery period.
Yeah, absolutely. So they would be the things that you would look for straight after that weigh-in period's done. It would be the fluid, get the fluid in there with the sodium, and then following with the carbohydrate, and even exploring the possibility of, hey, let's put some creatine in there to help with that glycogen resynthesis.
Yeah. I think the thing that I guess we probably should have talked about first with the glycogen resynthesis is that carbohydrate intake, and A, how you administer that, and B, how you stay on top of it. I think you see, particularly in the UK, you know, quite a lot of fighters, they'll weigh in, you know, they'll have a little bit of carbs, and then almost within an hour or so, they'll have forgotten about the fact that they should be consuming relatively high glycemic index carbohydrates. You know, they're often straight down to Nando's and eating like two chickens or whatever. You know, so the important thing from the practitioner's perspective, and of course the athlete's perspective, if the athletes are listening, is staying on top of that rate of carbohydrate intake for at least probably 4 to 6 hours, maybe. You know, and I think you're talking, if possible, it's kind of small and often. So, from a practical perspective, when I was working with athletes, the thing that I used to do was certainly for the first 2 hours, we would normally just do little carbohydrate snacks every 20 to 30 minutes, you know, and if you look at and you take the data from the exercise literature, we're looking at like 1 to 1.2 grams per kilo of kind of relatively high glycemic index carbohydrates per hour, not in total, per hour, you know. So To achieve that, you need to really stay on top of it. It's not an easy rate of carbohydrate intake to have. And what you'll tend to see with a lot of athletes is that they'll perhaps bang a load in the hour after weighing in, and then they'll kind of just go back to having their normal pasta and, you know, quinoa or whatever they would normally have. But you need to stay on top of it. And I think that early phase is really important. And then after that first 4 to 6 hours, you know, and there'll be a couple of, I would normally have a couple of meals in there as well. So we used to do meals at like 2 hours and 6 hours, or 2 and 5. But between those, still having carbohydrate in drinks, carbohydrate in little snacks, you know, cereal bars, sweets, chocolates. You know, we look at those things and think they're bad for you, but they're actually probably ideal for the athlete to be consuming. So that was that's probably the most important thing. And looking at that total carbohydrate intake over that day to really get that glycogen back to where it was, or if not higher than where it was at the start.
Absolutely. I was just trying to do a little bit of maths there. Say if we had like a 70 kilo athlete, so about 70 grams per hour, which is about 280 grams in the first 4 hours or so, which isn't, it's a decent amount, but it's doable if you stay on top of it.
Yeah, exactly. And if we're looking for those kind of like, which we probably should be, that kind of, you know, 10 grams per kilo for the day, then, you know, if you then offset that with maybe 2-3 meals over the course of the day later, and you're still having some carbs in your drinks, you're still having some, you know, desserts and stuff with those meals, then you can attain those high levels, and you've put quite a lot in early to give yourself the best chance of trying to resynthesize that glycogen. The other thing that I trialed with a few athletes towards the end of when I was advising athletes was, even with that, some of the athletes, you know, and these are like people that were competing in the UFC, some of them, would still say that they still didn't quite feel right come fight time. It wasn't all athletes. They just felt like they didn't have the same energy that they would normally have. And I wonder, and I'd love to see, if someone wants to do a study looking at muscle biopsies and recovery from rapid weight loss, I'd love to see the data. There's only one study published in the 80s that's done it, and they only looked 3 hours post weigh-in, and they saw basically no muscle glycogen resynthesis in that time. I'd like to see 24, 36 hours, but whether these guys are getting all of that glycogen back in. So one of the things we started doing in that kind of final maybe day before making weight was, in that phase, in my mind, probably the most important thing is the weight of anything you put into that athlete. So if something weighs very little, but perhaps can provide some things that might be beneficial for them, then that might be a viable strategy. So with a couple of athletes, we trialed this, we started giving people sweets in that 24 hours before making weight. So, and you know, we used to use Haribo or something like that. And, you know, they'd maybe have 200 or 300 grams of Haribo in that, you know, 24 hour period before making weight. Now in that time, they would normally not really be drinking anything at all. They'd be almost completely fluid restricting. And the idea of that was getting ahead of the game with the glycogen resynthesis. So if we're consuming that carbohydrate in that time period, some of that carbohydrate should theoretically go into the muscle and be stored as glycogen. And that means when they're starting their actual recovery from making weight, you're starting from a higher starting point, and maybe you give yourself a better chance of getting that glycogen in. And certainly it, you know, anecdotally from those few athletes, it did seem to have a beneficial effect, whether it was psychological, you know, when you're in that final stage of cutting weight and you're sat in a hot bath or in a sauna and you've got like 50 grams of sweets to eat at the same time, you know, it didn't seem to noticeably affect their ability to lose weight. It's only 200 or 300 grams, but it had a positive psychological effect during that time, and it seemed to give them more energy come fight time, which was the kind of symptom that they were struggling with.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. So my team and I have this thing that we call the blueberry effect. And this is something very similar that we do with our athletes when we're at the facility that we make weight, is we keep a bag of frozen blueberries in there. And we describe it as like a sensu bean. And if there's younger listeners that are listening in, if anyone watches that cartoon Dragon Ball Z, it's like the sensu bean that brings people back to life. And that's we call it the blueberry effect, is that we get a spoonful of blueberries when these guys finish each round and they're in their making weight process. So if they're cutting weight in the bath and then they do a wrap and they get a spoonful of blueberries, and it's, you know, marginal in the weight, probably marginal in the fructose that it's containing. But even if it's that carbohydrate mouth rinse principle where they think that they're getting this, anecdotally, I completely agree with that. It's almost like you're bringing these guys back to life and they're getting a second wind. And if you're not doing that drastic of a cut, it I'm not going to say it makes it an enjoyable experience, but it definitely makes it much more tolerable for the athlete. So I think there's definitely merit in that.
Yeah. And I mean, that brings in another factor as well in that final, you know, whatever they're doing with that kind of, you know, dehydration phase is you know, ice cubes are another really good one. So, you know, the water's coming out of them, they're sweating it out, but that doesn't mean they need to feel bad whilst they're doing it. And of course they will feel a bit bad, but again, you know, I would give people like an ice cube allowance during that time. So they could consume the ice cubes. And of course you've got to suck an ice cube, so it's there for ages, you know, and you get way more out of it than if you just drank that kind of thimble full of water that you would get for an ice cube. So that again really kind of help them with that, you know, perceptual experience. The other thing that we didn't talk about there was, you know, that kind of background of heat acclimation and how that can help with that process as well. And that's another one that would be useful. And again, that's not necessarily new. There's some cool research out there now, but you think about boxers. What's the one thing that boxers used to do with all their training throughout the fight camp? You know, and everyone would go, it's ridiculous, don't do it. But it's wearing like rubberized suits. They would train with like sweatsuits for weeks and weeks and weeks. You know, and everyone would go, oh, well, it's, you know, fake weight loss. You're not losing weight. It's, you know, it's just water weight you're losing. But actually what they were doing by doing that probably was actually heat acclimating themselves. So, losing the weight is easier because you sweat faster. Your core temperature is naturally lower, so you're at lower risk. And your plasma volume, which is another classic adaptation to heat acclimation, is expanded. So you're starting from a higher and a safer plasma volume. So yeah, using that heat acclimation to get the final stages of weight loss is more safe and easier for the athlete is a good one as well.
Yeah, it's funny. Hey, I remember the first time I ever spoke to someone about heat acclimation, and it was kind of like the full circle. Hey, it's like we used to say that training in the sweatsuits is absolutely ridiculous, and now we're coming back around saying, hey, actually, maybe there might be something in there to it. But anyway, Lewis, I think there's probably plenty. We could talk for hours and hours. I think I really want to get you on next time. We might even dive in more around that acute weight loss stage and you know, the sauna and the bath, because obviously you've got a ton of hands-on experience with that as well. So we can talk about that. But I think for that episode, that's absolutely phenomenal. In the meantime, if people listen to that and they go, hey, I want to pick Lewis's brains about a couple of things, what's the best way for them to get onto you?
I mean, if you search me, I'm at Loughborough University in the UK. So if you search Lewis James Loughborough University, my profile page will come up and my email's there and everything, and you can drop me an email. I'm always happy to chat to people about weight category stuff. You know, it's a personal pet interest of mine. So, you know, whilst I can't do all the like research that some other people can do at the moment, my research is in some other spaces, all linked. But I'm always happy to chat. I mean, I spent an hour and a half on the phone to someone in Costa Rica yesterday talking about weight category stuff. So I'm always happy to chat. So if someone wants to ask me a question, get in touch, you know, go through that. Or I'm on Twitter. I think I'm at LJJ_nutrition. And yeah, I'm keen to hear from people. Yeah, keep the dialogue going and, you know, support all the really good research that loads of people are doing around the world.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Dr. Lewis, I really appreciate you coming on. I appreciate you busy taking the time to, I'm always appreciative when you guys take, you know, this hour, an hour and a half and come talk to us, because it really does make a difference. And I know the listeners from the feedback that I get, and I guess in the academic world with us, I guess this is stuff we talk about all the time, but it's good getting it out there. And I do really feel that, you know, you coming out and sharing your experience is going to make a difference. So it's great. So I really appreciate it.
I appreciate the invite. And I think having listened to a few of the podcasts now, Jordan, I think what you're doing is great. And I think there's a lot of misinformation out there in weight cutting, in MMA particularly. And I think what you're doing with this series and, you know, continual learning for you as well, I guess, you know, is fantastic. And so hopefully you can carry on doing the great work you're doing with the fighters and making everyone more safe.
Appreciate it, Lewis. We'll leave it there. And no doubt I'll catch up with you soon.
Great. Cheers, Jordan.
And there it is, another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. Due to his practical and academic experience, Dr. Lewis raises some extremely important points when it comes to acute weight loss, rehydration, and refueling. By translating research from other fields, we can improve the mental and physical experience of acute weight loss for combat athletes. This podcast will be available through the podcast app, iTunes, Spotify, and you'll also be able to download it from my website, www.thefightdietitian.com/podcast. If you enjoy listening to the podcast, then be sure to head to the podcast app to give us a rating and leave us a review. Thanks for listening in, and I'll see you guys for the next episode of the Fight Science Podcast.